Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi, folks. We thought we'd do a bit of a bonus podcast. We had loads of stuff we wanted to go through and didn't have time on Friday's podcast. So me and Hugo are going to, are going to record a quick thing that we can put out on Saturday and Sunday just to finish covering the things we wanted to cover. And the thing I really want to talk about is the idea of who's behind the Great Reset, because this is not a conspiracy theory. And I did a video on our second channel that you may not be aware of that we'll leave linked in the description. The channel's called The Lotus Eaters, and the video is just called The Great Reset is Not a Conspiracy Theory, because in it I just go through all of the rich and famous and powerful people who are just promoting the idea of the Great Reset just verbatim. It's a movement. It's not a conspiracy. But Hugo's been doing a lot of good work on this, writing articles about it, but unfortunately his website is still down at the moment. You can't read them, so we figure this might be a good way of transmitting some of that information. So who is behind all of this, Hugo?
Well, actually, it's interesting that you present it in this way, because when you say who's behind it, it sounds like a conspiracy, even though it's not, because it's very open. It's actually a plan and agenda, let's say, that the World Economic Forum has launched, and it's public, and they're actually aiming for it to be as public as possible, because that's the goal. If you can make it as public as possible and get as many people on board, many high-profile people on board as possible, then
you'll how movements succeed.
Yeah, you'll be able to achieve those goals that you want to achieve, because you'll be able to change a lot of hearts and minds, right? And so as I said, it started with the World Economic Forum. At least that's the organization that provides the header for it. And so basically, we should probably take Klaus Schwab's word for it, because he's the founder and executive director of the World Economic Forum, and he's also written a book on it, which is called The Great Reset. You can buy it on Amazon.
Yeah.
So it's not secret. You can buy it on Amazon.
Yeah, and so I did a bit of digging into Klaus, and I mean, his CV is on the World Economic Forum website, mm-hmm. and he's an incredibly credentialed German economist. And I have my disagreements with other German economists, if we can charitably call them that, from the 19th century. But Klaus seems to actually be kind of... He's not a communist. I'm not saying he's a communist, but he is in the same sort of mold as the communists, in the way that they think of economics as a totality of and systemic, so that the system can just be manipulated at will and desired results theoretically can be engineered. Now, I guess I would say probably more Austrian when it comes to this. Another German economist, in fact, so I don't know why I'm criticizing, but I think the economy is more complicated than they're giving credit for, but I'm no economist.
Actually, I heard a good characterization of this, which is basically the difference between liberalism, the original liberalism, and then neoliberalism, which is basically what we've been talking about. Not really. But no? The neoliberalism that's come out of the 50s and the right, but the post-war right. And basically what the difference comes down to is that a lot of these, a lot of high-level prescriptions are similar. So, for example, like privatizing something, some sectors, slashing regulations in some sectors. But the main difference is how they actually see the economy and the kind of how would I say it, the nature of the economy and what it actually is. And so liberalism sees it as an emergent system, right? And neoliberalism sees it as a constructed system, something that you create, and you actually create the free market.
Yeah.
You create the free market by kind of government system
by setting a series of rules by
exactly.
which things happen.
So you have a government which kind of sets up the economic system, and within that you have the free market, and that's what free market is, right?
Yeah.
But that's not the liberal position originally. The liberal position is that's what emerges if you let people do what they want to do.
Yeah, it's the independent action of individual agents acting in their own economic self-interest, mm-hmm. a la Smith, Adam Smith style, where they're operating as individuals mm-hmm. who are in a localized setting and look at the world through localized lens. And so the baker buys nails from the nail maker, mm-hmm. the smith, and you know we all make money that way.
I mean, it doesn't even have to be local. It can be global. It can be as big as you want. But the point is,
I probably didn't use exactly the right terminology there. What I mean is. The sort of traditional liberal way of looking at the economy is that it's an aggregate of individual actions rather than being a system that can be designed.
Right, yeah, I understand, yep.
So, okay. Yeah, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you if you were talking about Klaus Schwab and how he probably sees the world based on what he's...
Not even probably. I watched a bunch of his lectures and, like, World Economic Forum. Yep. He definitely sees it this way.
Yeah, so like, when people are talking about neoliberalism and criticizing neoliberalism... They're probably right in the way that it's not the same as the classical liberalism and the kind of the shortcomings of neoliberalism are exactly what the criticisms I actually really allege, because it is the constructed system then that if it's constructed in some way, it's going to have defects which come from the way that it's constructed, right?
Yep.
And so you can have, like, people who allege that the system is racist because it's constructed in a racist way or something like that, and it can be credible because you don't have something that emerges and that just is a result of people in society interacting with each other.
Yeah,
if you have something that is imposed from above,
intentional, then you can ascribe a negative intent to it. But if it's an emergent system, you can't ascribe a single ethical intention to the system.
Yep. That's exactly what I meant. And so he's probably right. When he sees the world as being this way rather than emergent, right? He can also change it. But I'm saying he in his mind, but he also with a lot of other people who are in positions of power, and so you can then change the system based on to result in some results that you want to actually see, so that the outcome reflects your values.
Yeah, and but the point is the presupposition of the way that Klaus Schwab seems to see this, and the same way that I think a lot of German economists have seen it, and sure, like other economists as well, mm-hmm. so German economists seem to get really famous for some reason, is that he has the authority to be able to take ownership and managerial control over the system of what I would describe as individual autonomous choices, and change them, and have a constructed agenda for millions of people, and that's where I look at what he's proposing and recoil in horror, because to me, this seems no different, at least in principle, if even in practice. And we can get into, in fact, how he disagrees with it in practice, disagrees with, say, something like communism in practice. Mm-hmm. But it's that he's starting from the same assumptions. And, I mean, he feels, when I was listening to it, it felt to me like he was saying he understood the problems of the 20th century, and I'm sure he does, because he's a very intelligent man, clearly, and is seeking to modify what had happened and what had come before, rather than adopting a different paradigm. And that bothers me, because, I mean, at one point in particular, I found it really interesting how he was talking about the management of the system overall, but he did ascribe, and it was a very small portion of what he was saying, to, well, we recognize that entrepreneurship is important, and that is, you know, something that humans need to do. There has to be room for growth. There has to be, but the way he was phrasing it made it sound like he was like, well, maybe, you know, 5 or 10% of entrepreneurship. It's like, no, almost everything we have is the product of entrepreneurship. Like, it's like even everything that governments do were not originally done by governments. Mm-hmm. Eventually, it just becomes a technology or a system or whatever it is that's so ubiquitous, it just makes sense for the government to take it over, like roads.
Not exactly that it makes sense, but it makes it easy for them.
Yeah. Not just, but it makes sense for society, right? To have
Society is not the state.
I agree, but the state has to manage society in some ways. So it just makes sense for everyone to have the government manage roads, because then we pay a smaller premium. It's just, you can drive anywhere. It's just a useful thing for the government to
do. Because monopolies in other sectors produce higher prices. So why not in this sector?
Because you don't have tolls on the roads. You've just got the road tax.
Yeah, you still pay for it.
You do.
And so,
I'm not arguing the case for or against.
It's not free when you don't have tolls.
No, I'm not saying it's free. What I'm saying is this is just what has happened. When a service becomes ubiquitous, often the government takes it over to make sure that everyone can get it. Mm-hmm. Whether that's good or bad.
Yeah, sure.
I agree. Right. Not saying it's not free. But the point is, all of these things generally come about through private initiative. Mm-hmm. Like the NHS, all of these things came about through private initiative. And are taken on by the government, usually under socialist pressure. Mm-hmm. But anyway, getting with Klaus Schwab, bit of a diversion there. So he's obviously an expert German economist. And he founded the World Economic Forum. And he seems to have had this particularly long-running contention. He found the World Economic Forum in 1971, and he did it alongside a book called, this is an exciting-sounding title, Modern Enterprise Management in Mechanical Engineering. Just a page-turner, I've got no doubt. It was flying off the shelves, right? But in it, he argued, I haven't read it, so I'm just taking someone else's summary here, sorry about that. In it, he argued that companies... The management of a modern enterprise must not serve only shareholders but all stakeholders, and that's the die Interessenten, which is those with interest, right? To achieve long-term growth and prosperity. Now, he expands on what he means about this in various talks and stuff like this. And what he essentially means is all of society. I don't think that actually is large enough. It kind of means the entire world, because it is true that, you know, all of these systems from, you know, the mining of a graphite in Africa or wherever to the, you know, the harvesting of the wood in South America, and then they all get put together in a factory in China, and then they get sold, and suddenly I have a pencil in my hand in the West. It is a giant international series of systems that are all interlocking, and they're all supporting one another. And he seems to take the view that there should be an ethical agenda for the rest of society. And what he means, and in fairness, I do agree with him that these systems should be fair and they should serve the interests of the people working in them. Mm-hmm. And these people should not be left out. And I mean, essentially, he sounds like he's trying to argue in principle against a kind of neo-feudalism where we're all working for less than minimum wage, you know, for pennies a day at Amazon, stacking boxes or whatever, right? He sounds like he's trying to avoid that circumstance, but he seems like he's trying to avoid it by just jumping straight to the end.
I mean, he's an economist, he should know better.
Right. I'm sure he does. And he holds many, many degrees and doctorates, so I'm sure he does. But I really have to question all of this. But sorry, go on.
When you said before that, like, he's doing this thing, like, he's basically controlling or pushing to control people.
The sort of centralization.
Exactly. To, like, basically enact technocratic control of some sort. I don't think, like, he would definitely not see it this way. He would see this this initiative and his career and this whole system would see it as something that is deliberative, that is something that a lot of people come together, they talk about their ideas, they talk about what would be best, right? And so because it's this huge forum, World Economic Forum, right? It's this huge forum of people, huge agglomeration of basically everyone from every part of the world, they feel like they represent everyone, right?
Yeah.
And they feel like they're taking the best from the countries and areas, and those people who are the best of what society can offer come together in this one place. They say what's on their mind. They offer their insights into things, and then they decide what's best. And because then they actually do it, right? But so if they do it this way, they don't see it as tyranny or they don't see it as technocracy, because they take input from everyone, right? Mm-hmm. It's a similar principle as democracy, right? So you take a lot of input from a lot of people and then you impose a uniform solution on everyone, right? And so this is the same principle. And that's one of the reasons, I think, why this is so popular among
technocrats. Like,
not exactly, but among educated people and smart people and accomplished people, right? Because it's like democracy is something ubiquitous and something with which
in
almost,
principle, we
almost
agree
every
is a good
everyone
idea.
Almost everyone agrees that it's a good idea, and so if you have this, which is the basically the same principle, and you apply that, we might see it as wrong, but a lot of people don't see it as wrong because it's basically the same principle as democracy, but in applied to a different thing.
Yeah.
Not even to a different thing, but in different contexts. It's not a state doing it, but it's the World Economic Forum doing it.
But the problem is, it's not appropriate to economic activity, in my opinion. I don't think that other people should be controlling my economic activity.
Exactly.
That's up to me, you know. There was something I was going to add there that's just slipped my mind, which is really frustrating. but anyway, never mind. I'll try and remember what it is later on. So I watched... it's not just Klaus Schwab, although he is the principal... proponent behind it seems, like you said, he wrote a book on it. There are lots and lots of articles on the World Economic Forum just saying they want a great reset.
So I want to point the viewers to the World Economic Forum website. It's at intelligence.weforum.org, and if you go there, you have a beautiful graph. I'll try to show it on screen.
You should have got this up in advance.
Yeah, sorry about that. So you have this like nice circle where there's topics connected and everything's kind of like neatly organized. And here on this side, you have articles and resources which you can go through, which will tell you what basically the people who are participating in this are talking about and thinking. So a lot of the things that maybe we'll be citing later are just going to be taken from this. So basically, articles which are from the people participating in the Great Reset Initiative or the people endorsed by the World Economic Forum by providing them with this platform.
Do you have anything you want to go on for from then?
I wanted to like briefly mention the structure of Klaus Schwab's book because so that people have actually an idea what the content of the Great Reset is. And so it's got several parts. There's the macro reset part, the micro reset part, and the individual reset part. I don't know if it's exactly individual. Sorry
something
about
that.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly. Each of the parts takes the issue of resetting something from like a different scale, different perspective. But the most interesting, I think, is the macro part, which then divides into several sections, which is an economic reset, a social reset, a geopolitical reset, an environmental reset, technological reset, and things like that, right? And so in these sections, he talks about how things need to change within these spheres in order for the world to emerge better from the pandemic.
Ah, right. Sorry, just to interrupt you. I just remembered what it was I was going to say, right?
Go on.
I think there's, this is actually a perfect way of framing it, right? So he's got these four categories under which he is assuming that he has the authority to have any kind of control over. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is generally the... underlying emotional complaint that comes from people like Klaus Schwab, because he's going to be like, well, I'm a mathematician, he's going to speak in his German accent, and he's going to make it sound like he's very, very neutral and objective about all these things. But fundamentally, he is a human being, and if we are to believe the left-wing attack on objectivity, then Klaus Schwab can shut up and we can use those arguments to get him to stop. Because what is clearly happening is a feeling of a loss of agency. And that's the problem that the sort of individualistic sort of local, again, I don't have a better phrase for it, I'm sure there is one, but the sort of like atomized view of economics has. It's a chaotic system. It's chaos. It's incredibly hard to predict what people are going to do with their money and, you know, their spending habits and stuff like that will be in 5 years' time. You know, so there is no overriding feeling of control over the system, because there is no real one system. Mm-hmm. There is, in fact, lots of different interconnecting systems all dependent on one another that are all managed by sensible, presumably pragmatic decisions in the moment by the people who are actually engaged in them. And the classically liberal position is the individual is competent and capable of dealing with their own economic interests as related to the rest of their personal interests, and we can leave them with a set of clear rules in which they can operate, enforce contracts, and then assume they can get on with it by themselves, and this seems to work. We've achieved a great deal of prosperity with this kind of system.
Sure, but it's also why classical liberalism kind of defeats itself, because it has this kind of presumption that these people are going to do this, but they're not.
I totally agree. And it can be exploited. People can be fooled. People can be taken advantage of, whatever it is. But fundamentally, I think there is a kind of personality type that objects to this kind of chaos. They're the kind of personality type who would sit there and draw up a global list of things that need to be fixed and a series of systemic ways of doing that, and thinking that actually, you know, that means that I'm the guy with all the answers, so I should be the one who gets to do all this. And it's just to be clear, the World Economic Forum is a private institution. It's privately created by Klaus Schwab. If you don't like his ideas, then there's no compulsion in it, theoretically, until governments, and there are governments all around the world listening to this, until they start implementing it. So there's, you know, I think it's important to be aware of this. But sorry, I interrupted you.
No. I just wanted to say that it was privately founded, but I think by now it will definitely have a lot of government money. So, and but that's not where its power comes from. Its power comes from his ability and the people inhabiting it. Yeah. Their ability.
The fact that the great and good listen.
Exactly. It comes from their ability to bring people together to talk about stuff and then do stuff that they decide is good. But yeah, so that's basically what I wanted to say. Like, it's the line gets blurred, but like whether it has a direct influence or an indirect influence, because we don't live in a world where most type of influence is exerted through guns.
Yeah.
So, but there was another thing that I wanted to say, actually. Now that it's interesting that Klaus Schwab and other people like this actually think in this way that you just described, like having like these problems in the world that you want to fix.
Right? Yep.
Because for me, as like a private person that has almost no influence whatsoever, it would never occur to me to imagine the world in this way, because I have no power over the world like that, right? And so it only comes with certain status or power that you start thinking about the world this way.
Yeah, the and scope you, of the world.
Exactly. So then you start getting these like images in your head or whatever, and like ideas.
Wouldn't it be nice if everyone just did this?
No. Just ideas that you can actually affect the world. You can actually enumerate the problems that the world has and then try to solve them. Because if you're like a private person doing like something in their basement, like you just can't do it, so you don't think about it at all, because it just never occurs to you. That's not an option.
But it is very much a feature of German thought, and has been for probably time immemorial. And so I do get very concerned when people start going, well, actually, I've got plans for everyone in the entire system. And not just, I mean, it's bad enough for one country. If the 20th century has shown us anything, it's bad enough when just one country becomes like this. Putting someone who thinks that they're the competent person and the morally responsible and incorruptible person in charge of the economic system in the entire world, I have massive doubts about. And instinctively, I just want to say no. But anyway, I was watching... sorry, did you...
No, go on. Right. Yep.
So I was watching some of the presentations that they have on the World Economic Forum, where they're arguing for the Great Reset. And so I thought I'd just look into some of the people who were on the stage. Mm-hmm. And one of the people there was a guy called Thierry Malaret. And I couldn't find a Wikipedia bio of him, but I could find a profile for him at a website called theglobalist.com. They describe themselves as a magazine that is being run by people who, quote, do not believe in the superiority of any one culture. Just open globalist, then. So, like, Alex Jones style, open globalist.
It's funny that Alex Jones gets proven right.
I mean, like...
Alex... Alex Jones, like, it's so like provocative in how he speaks and what he does that it people often assume. Sounds like nonsense.
Yeah.
But like a lot of people are open about like this, people who are doing like the Great Reset initiatives and who work for the World Economic Forum and others in like international sphere are like proud of their work and proud of their lives and like. And with good reason, they're accomplished people. Like they've done a lot, and like we might think it's bad. A lot of people think it's bad, but like it's major accomplishments, right? So you would be proud of yourself if you were in that position. So
let me give some of Dr. Thierry Mallet's accomplishments. He was educated at Sorbonne and French places, and at St. Anthony's College in Oxford. He holds two master's degrees in economics and history and a PhD in economics. So the phenomenally accomplished people. He's written several academic books. He was a senior partner at Geneva-based Informed Judgment Partners, headed a global risk network and the Economic Forum at Davos in Switzerland. And he conceived and put in place the program for the annual Davos meeting that spoke at global industry and regional events. Tremendously successful and accomplished person, seems to be openly advocating for a one-world economic and governmental system.
Yeah, I mean, the worrying thing, in my opinion, about these types of people is not something like that they would favor like globalization or something or
I think they would.
Or
but that's not necessarily bad.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I meant. Sorry for not being clear about it. It's not necessarily the bad thing about what they kind of believe is not necessarily just that globalization like is good, and that people should trade more, nations to trade more, you avoid war by trade, things like that, like a lot of most people probably can get behind.
Yeah.
But it's the governing part of this that is, in my opinion, very objectionable. Yeah. Because I don't want to say they, because we're just talking about one person, and everyone believes something else, something different.
All of these people seem to be very much on the same page on this.
Yeah,
issues.
Sure.
So I think we could legitimately say they being the World Economic
Forum. Yeah, it sounds kind of like weird to say that.
Maybe just say the World Economic Forum believes, because that seems to be a consistent policy position that they advocate.
Yep. So the World Economic Forum believes that with this kind of economic globalization comes also political globalization, which is something which is a completely different thing, right? And the reason that they believe this is the case is because I think because of what I said earlier about the way that they think the economy actually exists, that it's constructed. So if it's constructed, you can't have the economic system globalized without the political system globalized, right?
You need to construct the global system.
Because if you don't construct the political system above the economic system, like you can't have the economic system globalized, because that can't exist. That just isn't the case, right?
It might work in practice, but it doesn't work in theory.
Yeah. They're smart people. I can't say what they would reply to this. I don't want to presume their arguments. But this is
the argument that they're making. Because the globalized economic system already exists without a government overseeing it.
Yeah.
Right. And so you have to, you know.
Yeah, but that's what they're saying. Like they're saying like it operates in some way now, but it's failing. It's got these major shortcomings, right? And that's what they wanted to fix with the Great Reset.
Climate, equality. What were the other things? There were four.
Right. It was just like political reset, societal reset, environmental. But it wasn't divided in this way.
Oh well, in other places I have seen it where they're talking about it, like literally divided. Like so, the complaint being income inequality, obviously climate change and the climate, and presumably various other social issues. They were the two that stood out to me because they were the two that I think are most contentious, I guess. But anyway, the next person on this panel that I was watching that I looked into was a lady called Sadia Zahidi. She's the managing director of the World Economic Forum and the author of the book 50 Million Rising, The New Generation of Working Women Transforming the Muslim World.
Sounds awesome.
Sounds progressive.
In the Muslim world.
You look forward to that, Pakistan, can't you? She is from Pakistan, incidentally. She grew up there, got a bachelor's degree in economics from Smith College, a master's in international economics from Geneva, and an MPA from Harvard University. Now, in her book, the bio, again, I haven't managed to read her book yet, obviously, women are challenging the familial and social conventions as well as compelling businesses to cater to women as both workers and consumers. More importantly, they are gaining the economic power that will upend entrenched cultural norms, reshape how women are viewed in the Muslim world and elsewhere, and change the mindset of the next generation.
But, I mean, you could... sure, that's how we view it from the West when, like, we're living in this, right? But at the same time, like, she's not addressing the West, she's addressing the entire world. So
The Muslim world specifically.
Exactly, like, she's saying the Muslim world and beyond, right? And beyond is, like, you have to say that, but she's a, so if her mission is to empower empower women and help women's rights in the Muslim world, then I definitely support her in that.
But it just adds to my theory that social justice is going to conquer Islam. I think it's going to happen. I think the Muslims are going to have to get used to being oppressive patriarchs. I mean, they are. So, in Pakistan and stuff, I think there are serious concerns about women's rights. But again, I'm just watching what I know is going to be the inevitable drip feed of social justice poison into a society. And it came from our societies, and it hasn't really done us all that much good. It hasn't raised happiness. Yeah. It's not something that looks sustainable from a family perspective. If you go forward like 100 years, something like this. Mm. And so I have my concerns. But the point is, the really important thing that I think is behind all of this is that these people are all economists. This is a very narrow field of human expertise. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not the only thing that pulls on a person.
And they're not just all economists. They're all economists of one school.
Yes. And they're very, very credentialed in that school, which means they've been in a particular mindset for a very long time. And I thought that for the sort of second half of this, what it would be worth doing is...
Before you start I want you to end this kind of segment with a quote from Klaus Schwab from the conclusion of his book. It's not the whole conclusion, so go and read it for yourself. But this is an excerpt from it. And so this illustrates quite well what you just said about the kind of wokeness in the whole program and about the way that it moves. Because, I mean, okay, if there's some concerns about like human rights and women's rights in the Muslim world, then that's probably very justified. But at the same time, if it goes in the direction that we by now know very well in the West, then that's probably not a good idea for us.
Right? There are ways to address violations of women's rights that don't involve communist subversion.
I absolutely agree.
That's what I would say. There are very strong liberal cases for women having the same rights as men that doesn't undermine the family or the nation state or the religion or things like this. And I'm not trying to play defense of Islam here, but at the end of the day, it is a foreign ideology that's going into specifically undermine the religious order of a country like Pakistan. And I totally despise the religious order of Pakistan. It seems to me to be highly oppressive, but who am I to say that you have to change?
And she's from Pakistan.
Well, exactly. But why approach it in a sort of more sort of social justice way and not a liberal way or a Christian way? She wouldn't do it a Christian way, but that would be an option.
I would rather that she approached it in a liberal way.
Same here.
So let me read out the quote then.
Go for it.
So this is from the conclusion of Klaus Schwab's book, The Great Reset.
Right.
Will we learn from the mistakes we made in the past? Will the pandemic open the door to a better future? Will we get our global house in order? Simply put, will we put into motion the Great Reset? Resetting is an ambitious task, perhaps too ambitious, but we have no choice but to try our utmost to achieve it. It's about making the world less divisive, less polluting, less destructive, more inclusive, more equitable, and fairer than we left it in the pre-pandemic era. Doing nothing or too little is to sleepwalk towards ever more social inequality, economic imbalances, injustice, and environmental degradation. Failing to act would equate to letting our world become meaner, more divided, more dangerous, more selfish, and simply unbearable for large segments of the globe's population. To do nothing is not a viable option.
Well.
So we can leave it there and go to the second segment.
Well, with that kind of ethos, we can do anything, can't we? If we don't act, the world gets worse. So what possible? And he even says this in the presentation I was watching. He was like, you know, we will fulfill the demands which we have created for ourselves. It's like, well, I guess you will. I mean, I guess you've just made up this. Prove it, Klaus. Prove that this will be the case. You know, but Klaus is not just the author of the book, The Great Reset. He is also the author of what he called the Davos Manifesto. Now, the Davos Manifesto originally began as a set of principles that he wrote in a 1973 manifesto, but he republished it in 2019. Again, it's just listed on the World Economic Forum website.org under just in December 2019, the Davos 2020 Manifesto, and I kind of hate it. I really don't agree with it. It's very short as well. That's why I thought it was worth covering. And it's got three major points that are A, B, and C. And then point A has five subcategory points. So the manifesto begins with point A. This is, and I'm not reading out the entire statements, but he begins with the categoric statement and then justifies it and fills it in. But we don't need to worry about
it might be worth to say what the headline is, what the subtitle of the manifesto is. Yeah. It's the universal purpose of a company in the fourth industrial revolution.
Yes.
So it's basically something akin to the stakeholder capitalism that you were talking about earlier. That's his life's work.
Yeah. And it's the ethos that he is trying to put into things. Mm-hmm. And this is why I focused on them being economists first and foremost, and seems to be exclusive, because there are some significant concerns that I have with the way he's looking at this. So point A is, the purpose of a company is to engage all its stakeholders in shared and sustained value creation. Now, that I think is a true statement. Yep. And is a reasonable summary of what the traditional purpose of a company is: to produce a product or service that can be sold, which we could describe as sustained value creation. Mm-hmm. It's quite an abstract term, however, sustained value creation, mm-hmm. and it's up for interpretation, and it starts getting a bit strange if you were to start replacing, say, a company with something like the state, and sustained value creation can be interpreted with whatever you want, but it gives the idea of a company quite a broad remit, as in, if it's stakeholders, and as we saw earlier, that does not mean shareholders. That means
he actually says it means employees, customers, yeah. suppliers, local communities, and society at large.
Exactly, society at large. This is very, very broad. This is very broad. He's giving himself a mandate to address society at large through mm-hmm. his particular business interest. I think that's way too broad. That needs to be much more narrowly defined.
But what I think he says in this is not that like he or the World Economic Forum should control companies like this. But what he says is basically if I were to translate it to like crude language, companies should be more regulated because they don't do enough for the society.
Yes and no. I agree that is where he's going, but and that is true. But again, the problem is the fact that the limits he's setting are actually not limits at all, and could be expanded if desired into almost anything. I mean, mm-hmm. what is off limits here? Mm-hmm. What is off limits for the corporate interest to be concerned with? Because normally, like, corporate interest is actually quite narrow. It's like, right, okay, we're going to make money. Are we paying these people to do this service? Mm-hmm. You know, do we pay money to our shareholders? And so it's actually all quite easily defined. It's all visible. It's traceable. You know, it's sensible, right? But again, initially, nothing too terrible there. But and so the second one. So under point A, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So point 1A. A company serves its customers by providing a value proposition that best meets their needs. That's true. That's just the nature of an economic transaction. A company that fails to meet that standard does not remain a company for very long.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fine. No problem with that. But what we have done here in the first A and A1 is addressed is statements. We have addressed what is the case. These are traditionally accepted roles of companies. We can mm-hmm. point to examples. Every company has to follow these rules. And if they don't follow these rules, they'll go out of business.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fine. These are interests. But the second one is, a company treats its people with dignity and respect. This is not true. There are lots of companies that don't. There are lots of companies that have unethical practices. So what he has inserted into this is not an observation on reality. It is a moral imperative. And that's important, because I mean, like, any philosopher will instantly go, well, David Hume, you can't draw an ought from an is, which isn't true really, but what the complaint is that you are mixing up your moral desires with your practical observations.
And that's actually what he's doing really openly here, because he says a company treats its people with dignity and respect. He says it does this, right? But he means it should do this.
That's exactly right. And as soon as you say should, you have a judgment, a value judgment, which we can get onto the next one, in mm-hmm. fact. But that's the thing. It's a moral requirement he has introduced. It is not a statement of reality. It is not a description of reality. And this is where, again, philosophically, this is not straight. You know, this is easily manipulated or picked apart. But point three, a company considers its suppliers as true partners in value creation. Now, not only, again, is this not an observation of reality, mm-hmm. this is a should statement, mm-hmm. this is a moral statement, it gets worse, because now the term company is not merely something you can point to. Now, the company is making value judgments. So you have turned the company into an abstracted entity. And this is characteristic of Enlightenment continental thought all the way back to Rousseau. We get the general will. The general will is now something separate to the people, and now it is an entity on its own that has an ethical agenda. It has a will of its own. It is wide awake, as the fascists would describe it, right? And I mean this.
I know. You're right.
Yeah, in Giovanni Gentile's Origin and Doctrine of Fascism, he says the fascist state is wide awake and has a will of its own. And now Klaus Schwab, again, I don't want to have to keep pointing that at these German. He has done exactly the same thing with a company that the fascists did with the state. And also, as we saw from the previous one, he has made the interests of the company for all of society. And so he has completely copied the fascist conception, totalitarian conception, of what the source of the origin of power is. He's just transferred it to the company itself. So now the company is something that is greater than a human. It makes moral judgments, and it has moral and ethical concerns. So we get to part four. A company serves society at large through its activities, supports communities in which it works, and pays its fair share of taxes. Again, this is a should statement. It's not necessarily true. Many don't do these things. But moreover, many aren't required to do these things. There are lots of companies that don't serve society at large, but serve a specific subset of society.
Exactly.
And you see many of these being small independent creators who create art on Patreon or something like this for niche communities, you know, whatever it is. But the
great nice weekend podcasts.
Exactly, make lovely podcasts like this one. So again, a moral statement that is an imperative. And then five, a company provides shareholders with a return on investment. I guess, I mean, again, we can put it in the category of this is true, or it doesn't become, doesn't provide, continue to be a company for very long. But again, not all companies do, some fail. Mm-hmm. So again, it should do this. And but then we get to point B. That was all point A. And again, not consistent. And any philosopher would have been able to go through that and tell him. A company is more than an economic unit generating wealth. It fulfills human and societal aspirations as part of the broader social system. Performance must be measured not only on returns to shareholders, but also on how it achieves its environmental, social, and good governance objectives. Executive remuneration should reflect stakeholder responsibility. So he has essentially turned a company into a government. This is the sort of thing that a government is concerned about. A company, in my opinion, if it's just an economic unit, an economic organization, does only care about this thing. Shut up, Cobbs.
I'm coming for you.
Yeah, I know. Oh, God, he's criticizing the Great Reset. We're all in trouble, lads. but yeah, so, I mean, and the thing is, it's not that his intentions are bad, right? The intent is not bad here. What he wants is sort of socially responsible companies that don't pollute the environment, that don't screw their workers over, that don't, you know, demand that they work weekends and do podcasts, that, you know, things like this. Like I understand why he's.
By the way, it's Friday today. It's okay.
Yeah, it's all right. I'll make them come in next weekend. but no, I understand why he's doing all of this. The intent behind it. He's not an evil man. He just has a particular way of thinking, and I don't think that thinking is actually very clear, and I don't think it's taking into account many other forces that will pull on not only society, but companies and all of these other things. And then we get to point C, a company that has a multinational scope of activities not only serves all those stakeholders who are directly engaged, but itself acts as a stakeholder, together with governments and civil society of our global future. Corporate global citizenship requires a company to harness its core competencies, its entrepreneurship, its skills and relevant resources in collaborative efforts with other companies and stakeholders to improve the state of the world. That's not really what companies are about. Improving the state of the world is actually a convenient byproduct of self-interest and people's own natural economic impulses. It's just a good thing that I guess Adam Smith had that figured out. Again, giving it an ethical agenda is actually kind of scary, because this is how you end up with woke capital, where you've got all of these companies with Black Lives Matter, pride flags, all this sort of stuff, and deplatforming people who are against the ethical agenda. Because Getting back to what the fascists had to say about it, unfortunately, I have to cite them, but I mean, if you're going to use their thought process, yep, don't get angry at me, because the fascists were very annoyed at the Night Watchman liberal state, which didn't have an ethical agenda. And the point of capitalism and the liberal state is that actually they are amoral. They're not immoral, which means they're bad, but they're amoral, which means they're actually just a tool, in the same way that a hammer or a spanner or a gun is amoral. It's not a moral proposition in and of itself. How you use it is the case, and that requires the individual's own personal intent and moral values. I know I'm getting going on for ages, but this is important. And the difference means that we can have what we would describe as an objective company, an objective state that just serves whoever it needs are required in society. And this is how we actually prevent a kind of woke corporate dystopia, by forcing these companies to serve everyone without preference to their race, their age, their sex, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And all laws we have, all ones I agree with, don't want to get rid of them. In fact, I would like them reinforced. I don't want our ethical companies taking over the entire world and then having their ethical agenda beam down on me and telling me, actually, you're bad. So, unpersoned.
I've got an interesting thing here you're talking about woke capitalism and woke companies, like, browbeating you with stuff. And I was actually watching Academic Agent's stream yesterday, and he was reviewing, or he was looking at old McDonald's adverts.
Yeah.
And it was great, because it was from the 60s until the late 70s. That's the place he covered. Go check that out after this, by the way. He observed how in the 60s it was kind of like business oriented, you know. It was basically, we have this product, this is good, like the company is doing these good things, like this is this, they wanted to attract customers, right? But then you get into the 70s, you get into the, like, first, I shouldn't say, probably shouldn't say first, but like first majorly publicized, like, woke wave. And then you see the McDonald's adverts started being like really this social justice-y kind of messages being pushed on the customers and on the public. And it's kind of like heartwarming at the same time, because like what's happening today, you can see it also happening in the 70s, and that also offers kind of hope that after today the 80s will come.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's nothing new under the sun, is there? But anyway, the point is, it's not any kind of conspiracy theory to mm-hmm. suggest that this is happening. It's not people who can't be named and, you know, unknown conspirators. No, no, no. You can go to the World Economic Forum website. You can watch all of these presentations. They have lots of them. They're very long. They're very boring. But they're also very rhetorical, and they're very sure that they're saving the world.
Corporate.
That's exactly the way to put it. They're very, very corporate. They are exactly the sort of thing that you would expect the product of PhD mathematicians to produce. Not compellingly human in their analysis, in my opinion. And I think they view companies as being far, far more... I was going to say necessary, but that's not the word I mean. Far more integral to the average person's life than I think the average person views them. I think the average person views companies as something separate to themselves, even if they work at them. And that's certainly how I looked at it when I was working at these companies. And I do have genuine concerns that, like you were saying earlier, every system contains within it like the seeds of its own destruction, because of the imperfections that it's been created with. And the larger the system, the greater these imperfections manifest, and the more damage that they do, which is why it's always good to devolve power. And when you have moral prescriptions contained within the way that you think these things should be done, you will get people making counter prescriptions and moral criticisms. And where's the room for that? How can we disagree?
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.